If you're taking care of a senior loved one, then you know it can be hard. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason why 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Experienced senior caregivers can help with everything from meal prep to taking your loved one to doctor's appointments. And every caregiver you hire is background checked. So important for peace of mind. Find full-time, part-time, or even occasional help that fits your family's schedule and budget. Get the support you need with Care.com.
This summer, Instacart presents famous summer flavors coming to your front door or pool or hotel.
Your grocery delivery has arrived, sir.
That was faster than room service.
No violins in the lobby.
Oh, seriously? Anyway, sit back, relax, and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Starring your favorite snacks, drinks, and more.
Download Instacart for free delivery on your first three orders. Rated H for hungry audiences. Offer valid for a limited time. Minimum $10 per order. Excludes restaurants. Additional terms and fees apply.
Hello and welcome back to the Prospect Podcast. I'm Ellen Halliday, and today I'll be joined by Mark Wilding, a journalist at Liberty Investigates, the investigative journalism unit at human rights organisation Liberty. Mark is the reporter behind Asylum King, a joint report between Prospect and Liberty Investigates into a man who has made millions from Britain's broken asylum system. The full report can be read on our website, in our app, and in the bumper summer double issue of Prospect. But Mark is also here today to tell us about the story and what it reveals about the way Britain manages asylum seekers. Mark, it's good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks, Ellen. It's great to be here.
So can you summarise for us and for our listeners, who is the Asylum King and why is his story an important one to tell?
So Graham King is a businessman from Canvey Island, a seaside resort in Essex. And he is one of the largest beneficiaries in recent years of the UK's asylum accommodation system. He's the founder of a company named Clear Springs, which over the past 25 years has gradually established itself as one of the most important providers of asylum accommodation to the UK government. And in one respect, it's an astonishing business success story. It's gone from being founded in 1999 to now turning over £1.3 billion. Its profits up more than 400-fold in the last few years. And Graham King has gone from being an aspiring entrepreneur to one of the UK's most successful businessmen, recently made the Sunday Times Rich List, so one of the richest people in the country.
And what does this asylum accommodation look like? What kind of accommodation is it?
So asylum accommodation can be a mix of different things. At the moment, a lot of it is hotels, and that's where it appears that a lot of Clear Springs revenue and profits have come from in recent years. So many asylum seekers are now housed in hotels, and that's largely because the government has needed to find new ways of accommodating the large numbers of people who are here awaiting decisions on their asylum claims. The asylum claims backlog has increased. During the pandemic, you know, things slowed down, and so hotels were part of that solution. Before that, it was largely rental properties in the private rented sector. And now things are shifting. So a big part of the Conservative government strategy was its large sites programme, which are places like the Bibby Stockholm that listeners will be aware of, the barge that was adapted to house asylum seekers, and now also like large sites like ex-military barracks. So Wethersfield is one of the most significant recent developments in that area.
And that is one of Clear Springs' sites?
Yeah, so there are three main accommodation providers that manage asylum accommodation on behalf of the Home Office. So Clear Springs is one of them. Serco is another big one, who listeners will probably be aware is, manages a number of different contracts for the government. And Mears is another one, which has a background in providing social housing.
So Serco and Mears have a range of kind of streams to the business, but is Clear Springs only focused on asylum accommodation?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that made Clear Springs really interesting and one of the reasons that we decided to start looking into the company and its founder. So, yeah, as you say, Serco and Mears have a number of different revenue streams and very difficult to establish, you know, how much of that comes from its asylum accommodation contracts and how profitable that side of its business is. Clear Springs is different in that asylum accommodation is essentially its sole business. It has some other areas that it works in. It has a software company, but if you look at its accounts, essentially most of its £1.3 billion turnover comes from two Home Office contracts providing asylum accommodation in the south of England and Wales. And that makes it a really interesting case study to look at to see the profitability of this sector.
I mean, that figure of £1.3 billion is one of the things that really jumped out to me when you first kind of, you know, came to us with this story. It's an absolutely huge number. Is it, in the kind of scheme of these government contracts, is it big or is it par for the course?
It's difficult to say, but £1.3 billion is obviously a big number. And when you look at the Home Office's annual budget, then it seems just as big. You know, the Home Office in 23-24, its entire annual budget for everything, like police, fire, you know, all the services that the Home Office manages, was just over £24 billion. So when one provider is, you know, turning over £1.3 billion, that suggests that it's around £1 in every 20 spent by that department. So, yeah, we're talking serious numbers here. Yeah.
That £1 in 20 pounds is really shocking sum. Another figure that really jumped out to me when you came to us with this story related to the conditions that asylum seekers experience in this accommodation. Can you tell us a bit about what you found and kind of some of the numbers that indicate the conditions that asylum seekers are experiencing?
Yeah, so there's been some good reporting over the years about the conditions in asylum accommodation. And this goes back to before it's been managed by, you know, the three providers that we've spoken about. But, you know, we're talking about properties. We should say that they vary in quality, and there are some, you know, good properties being used as asylum accommodation, and there are clearly some very poor ones as well. So there are reports of properties infested with vermin, with you know, rats running around the place. There are reports of, you know, broken facilities, you know, and then there's the management of it. You know, there are you know, the complaints made by residents of asylum accommodation include allegations of racist abuse, physical assault, confiscated belongings, you know, all kinds of awful things. And we should say that this doesn't just apply to properties managed by Clear Springs. You know, Serco and Mears have faced their own allegations as well. But we did find that when we looked at the number of complaints being made by asylum accommodation residents and compared those with the Home Office's figures for the number of asylum seekers being accommodated by its providers, the rate of complaints appeared to be significantly higher among Clear Springs residents.
There also have been a number of asylum seekers who've died in asylum accommodation as well.
That's right. Yeah, so this relates to some work that Liberty Investigates has been doing for some time. The team established something called the Asylum Seeker Memorial Project, and that was because the Home Office doesn't proactively publish data on asylum seekers who die while in the department's care. So that was based on data obtained through Freedom of Information, and that collates, you know, information on the number of people who are dying while housed in asylum seeker accommodation, and, you know, which provider was responsible for providing the properties that that they were living in. And so that provided a really rich source of data for us to look at and say, well, is there a difference between the government's three key providers? And when we looked into it, you know, this was one of the first bits of analysis we did and found that Clear Springs was an outlier here as well. You know, the mortality rate among residents of Clear Springs properties appeared to be significantly higher than those of Serco and Mears. And that, you know, was one of our starting points to say, well, you know, what's going on with this company?
Mark, you learned quite a lot about the conditions at some of these sites through FOI requests, looking at the data that was available. But you also spoke to some people who've experienced the conditions at some of these sites yourself, and you visited one of the sites that's currently run by Clear Springs at Weathersfield. Can you tell us what those people who you spoke to told you and what you saw as well with your own eyes when you visited the site?
Yeah, so, you know, groups who work with asylum seekers, the people who are living in this accommodation, have for a long time been raising concerns about the conditions there and, you know, the treatment of people who have to stay in asylum accommodation. And we saw quite an illuminating picture painted by documents that I obtained from the Home Office about, you know, complaints about asylum accommodation and, you know, the conditions there and the treatment by staff. But it was particularly illuminating to pay a visit to Wethersfield Asylum Centre. So this opened recently. It's a former military barracks that's been repurposed as asylum accommodation. You know, a really good example of the strategy that the most recent Conservative government was embarked upon. And you go to the site and it looks like a prison camp. You know, there are tall fences all around it, topped with barbed wire. There are signs telling you that CCTV is in operation. I couldn't get access to the site. I went to the gate, presented my press accreditation. The security there radioed off to ask if I could come in. And I heard back on the radio, that's a negative. The residents can leave. There are shuttle buses that will take them to nearby towns three times a day. Otherwise, you know, this place is in the middle of nowhere. So I met with a man, we called him Ibrahim. He didn't want to give his real name because he's understandably concerned. There have been reports that asylum seekers who have spoken out about the conditions, about where they're living, have been told that it could affect their asylum claim. So he understandably didn't want to be identified.
Where did he come from? How did he end up in Wethersfield?
He was from Sudan. It had taken him 4 months to reach the UK. He was an engineer back in Sudan, and he'd hoped to come to this country and, you know, pick up that career, build a new life. He'd spent 7 months in Wethersfield by the time that I spoke to him. He felt despondent that he'd wasted his time there. He wanted to be able to work or study to get the equivalent qualifications here. He hadn't been able to. And he painted a really bleak picture of what life is like in Wethersfield. You know, asylum seekers largely are not allowed to work, and there are no other diversions in this camp. As I said, it's in the middle of nowhere. He said there is a gym they can use with some broken equipment. They organise games of football in a sports hall, and otherwise they're pretty much left to their own devices. So it's very difficult to make friends there. Organisations like Médecins Sans Frontières and Doctors of the World have described an unfolding mental health crisis at the camp. You know, Ibrahim described, you know, struggling with his mental health himself, and that everyone else there was really just focused on how to get out rather than making friends. He showed me a picture of his accommodation on his phone. Essentially, they are temporary blocks that have been dropped in. They have six beds, six lockers, everything grey and white. It looked like a prison to me. And that was how he described it. He said it's like prison.
I mean, we should say that you've put all of these numbers and allegations about poor conditions to Clear Springs and to its owner, Graham King. Did they come back to you with any response?
They did respond very quickly, actually. After a number of hours, we sent them a very detailed outline of the article that we published. And they came back and said, you know, thanks for your email, but our response is no comment.
Given what you found out about, like, through data about the conditions asylum seekers are experiencing, as well as kind of the information about the money and the profits this company are making, why do you think it is that conditions in Clear Springs are potentially worse than elsewhere, and that they're able to continue kind of expanding and making so much profit out of this asylum, these asylum contracts?
Well, we should say that it's really difficult to quantify whether the conditions at Clear Springs are worse than at the other providers. But I think what we have shown is that there are some very concerning statistics that really no one seems able to provide the answers to. So we put these statistics to the Home Office as well. They declined to provide any on the record comment. But when the number of complaints and deaths are significantly higher at one provider out of three, it seems reasonable to ask, well, why is that the case? And, you know, so far, neither Clear Springs nor the department responsible for giving them the contract has been able to tell us why that is. And that seems like, you know, a really important question that, that should be asked. You know, when any company is making, you know, so much money from government contracts, you know, one side of it is the quality of the accommodation that's being provided. And as we've discussed, you know, there's some really concerning statistics that, that really, you know, should be looked into. But when a company is accounting for such a large proportion of the amount spent by one government department and is making, you know, staggering revenue, but also, you know, astonishing profits, up more than 400-fold, you know, since 2019, and its founder has, off the back of these government contracts, become one of the richest people in the country, I think, you know, those two facts together, staggering profits, one of the country's richest people, and at the same time, allegations that the service being provided, you know, is substandard. You know, I think, how do those two things fit together? And I don't think the Home Office has provided answers to that.
After the break, we'll talk more about asylum accommodation and the role of the new government going forwards. But first, take advantage of our special offer. Get 3 months of unlimited digital access to Prospect for only £3. Or take advantage of our introductory print and digital bundle offer of 3 issues for £3 to follow what the latest political updates mean for you. Just type in prospectmagazine.co.uk and click on subscribe to take advantage of this incredible offer.
If you're taking care of a senior loved one, then you know it can be hard. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason why 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Experienced senior caregivers can help with everything from meal prep to taking your loved one to doctor's appointments. And every caregiver you hire is background checked. So important for peace of mind. Find full-time, part-time, or even occasional help that fits your family's schedule and budget. Get the support you need with Care.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes in detail.
It took a lifetime to find the person you want to marry. Finding the perfect engagement ring is a lot easier. At BlueNile.com, you can find or design the ring you've always dreamed of with help from Blue Nile's jewelry experts who are on hand 24/7 to answer questions, and the ease and convenience of shopping online. For a limited time, get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more with code LISTEN at BlueNile.com. That's $50 off with code LISTEN at BlueNile.com.
Fair. Given that these are government contracts, what kind of accountability is there for these conditions that you found? Has there been any effort to improve things at Clear Springs and other accommodation sites across the country?
Well, the short answer to that question is that we found that there's very little accountability. You know, when the Home Office is spending this much money, you would expect that they would be taking steps to ensure that they're getting value for money, and that when they are outsourcing responsibility for looking after some of, you know, the country's most vulnerable people, that that job is being done properly. And the information that we got from the department through Freedom of Information requests suggests that there doesn't appear to be much appetite at all for monitoring or enforcing, you know, performance standards for these contracts.
How do we know that?
Well, we asked for a number of different things. We asked them to provide performance data for the three providers. And we know that they collect this information because I obtained a document. You know, the providers are required monthly to submit performance reports. And so we know that the department collects this information. There's a couple of issues with this. One is that the providers are submitting this information themselves. So there's an aspect of, you know, these companies marking their own homework here. The other is that the department said that to provide details of this, these, you know, performance and whether the contract requirements were being met, it would be too costly to provide that information. So there's a gap here. The providers are submitting it, but how can you manage a contract if you're not keeping in one place, you know, the data on whether, you know, the performance is as is required? And so, you know, if the department is saying it's going to take them several days to collect that information, you have to wonder how they are managing these contracts effectively. You know, there are other reasons to be concerned or questions to be asked about whether they're keeping a close enough eye on contracts that are so important and so costly. So in some cases, there are several layers of subcontractors involved in providing this accommodation. So Clear Springs owns very little property itself. It acts as a middleman and, you know, asks subcontractors to provide hotels or other accommodation. And in some cases, those subcontractors find more subcontractors. And there are several layers of companies that are taking their slice of the profit out of these contracts. And we found that the Home Office doesn't actually know who these companies are. So there is a requirement for the three providers to update the Home Office with details of the companies that provide services on their behalf. So I asked for those lists, and the Home Office sent them to me and said, these lists haven't been updated since 2019, when the contract started. And we found that they were missing the names of firms that we know are involved in providing accommodation. So I think there's another question there. How is the Home Office managing these contracts effectively if it doesn't even know who is providing the services on its behalf?
Mark, I'd love to delve a little bit more into those layers of opacity, I guess, around these contracts and these subcontractors and subcontractors under these asylum accommodation systems. That means that the Home Office isn't actually holding Clear Springs and other asylum accommodation providers, you know, necessarily to account as much as they might do. In order to do that, maybe we should just rewind a little bit and talk about how it came to be that private companies were the ones providing these key services on behalf of the government. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, so this goes back a long way. You know, this goes back to 1999, and this was the New Labour government. And there was a desire to change the way that asylum accommodation was provided. You know, we were seeing increasing numbers of people coming to the UK and seeking asylum. And there was a sense that the burden of looking after new arrivals was falling too heavily on local authorities in the southeast of England and London, where most people tended to arrive and make their claims. So the government decided that it would adopt what was known as the dispersal scheme. And that is, as it sounds, it would take people who had arrived to seek asylum and disperse them across the country. Now, before this point, asylum accommodation was the responsibility of local authorities. But at the same time as dispersing people around the country, the New Labour government decided that it would open up this sector to not just local authorities, but to voluntary sector organisations and, crucially, private companies for the first time. So private companies could bid to provide accommodation on behalf of the government. Over the years of the dispersal programme, and we should say that it almost immediately proved controversial. You know, I went to the National Archives and went through the cabinet correspondence for that time, and almost immediately Jack Straw, the Home Secretary at the time, is writing to Prime Minister Tony Blair and saying, this is dispersed asylum as a political issue. So beforehand, you know, communities in the southeast and London were perhaps used to seeing asylum seekers arrive. But suddenly, people who had arrived seeking asylum were being placed in, you know, villages and towns in the north of England, and communities that weren't used to sort of seeing this as an issue. Over the first years of the dispersal programme, I think it was private companies that proved the most efficient at sourcing and providing accommodation at the prices that the Home Office needed it provided. And so over time, it was private companies that emerged as the most successful bidders for these contracts, and the local authorities and voluntary sector organisations that were involved at the start gradually dropped away.
So coming back to today, should the Home Office, in your view, continue contracting private companies to provide asylum accommodation a practice that's now been going on for, you know, a couple of decades? And if not, what's the alternative?
Well, I think this is obviously a complicated issue to grapple with, and the solutions aren't straightforward because, you know, the successive governments over 25 years have been seeking solutions to this problem and clearly haven't found something that's working for everyone involved. I would say that there have been many opportunities for more radical solutions to be adopted, and every time the asylum accommodation system is overhauled, when the Home Office introduces new contracts, there are bodies that are urging the government to take an opportunity to do things differently. So whether that is the Home Affairs Select Committee, the Public Accounts Committee, the Independent Chief Inspector for Borders and Immigration, the National Audit Office, saying things need to be done differently, here's an opportunity to do it. The Home Office lands on contracts that look very similar to what was done before.
But do they suggest alternatives? You said there might be, you know, radically different ways of handling it. Do they offer?
Well, we saw this in 2019. So this was when the most recent asylum accommodation and support contracts were awarded. And we know, based on reports from the National Audit Office, that in the years before, the Home Office considered radical alternatives to the contracts it had before. And it thought about options, including like embarking on a house building program to house asylum seekers, or allowing asylum seekers access to mainstream benefits. You know, these kind of things, thinking differently about the problem. And despite extending the old contract by 2 years, it eventually concluded it didn't have time to consider radical alternatives and landed on new contracts that the National Audit Office described as being very similar to what went before. Mm-hmm. So there are different solutions to this problem. It's complex and we don't know what would work, but so far the government, you know, successive governments have tried the same approach again and again.
We've now got a new government, one that has campaigned under the slogan of change, and that many might hope would suggest some, you know, radically different ways of running the country. What evidence is there that asylum accommodation is something that's on the new Labour government's mind?
Well, we know that asylum, you know, the asylum system as a whole is very much on the new government's mind. Unfortunately, there is not a lot of evidence so far that overhauling asylum accommodation is a major priority. The talk during the election for both the Conservatives and Labour focused very much on essentially how they were going to stop the boats, to borrow Rishi Sunak's slogan. And I think the Labour government has shown that it's, you know, thinking seriously about how it's going to tackle demand effectively by tackling the gangs, as Starmer has put it, by trying to reduce the number of new arrivals. I think that is an approach. I think it's questionable as to the extent that's going to work. That's an approach that governments have been trying for 25 years and saying we're going to reduce the number of people arriving in this country. And yeah, I think it's highly questionable whether that's going to be an effective solution to this problem.
And if you were to have half an hour with the Home Secretary, what would you ask them to do?
I think my work looking into this issue has highlighted a number of concerning areas about how asylum accommodation is managed. I think, first of all, it's concerning that the Home Office isn't monitoring or enforcing performance standards in relation to such an important public service. And I think whether you come at this from the perspective of asylum accommodation is not serving the people who have to live there, it's not keeping them safe, it's not providing the kind of accommodation that, you know, we would hope to provide people who come to this country seeking sanctuary, or whether you come at it from, well, this is an issue about value for money for the taxpayer, and how is one company, effectively one man, making such huge profits from such a crucial government contract? But whichever way you look at it, the system doesn't seem to be working, and so I think it's reasonable to ask, you know, how is the new government going to do things differently?
Under recent Conservative governments, there's been a sense of this very kind of punitive hardline policy on immigration. What we're talking about is a system of asylum accommodation going back for much, much longer into the new Labour year. So to what extent are the conditions that you've reported on here the result of Conservative government policy, or rather kind of a more enduring system of under the Home Office and system of dealing with immigration across governments going back further?
I think that's a really important point. I think this is an issue that hasn't just arisen under recent, you know, Conservative governments. And you can see that in the solutions being adopted. You know, one of the issues with asylum accommodation, one of the reasons it's so difficult to manage, is that there is a contradiction at the heart of it. You know, on the one hand, when Robert Jemrick, who is now, you know, one of the contenders to be the new Conservative leader, when he was serving as immigration minister, he said we need to incorporate, you know, all aspects of the asylum system have to incorporate deterrence. So that includes asylum accommodation. So on the one hand, the government wanted asylum accommodation to serve as a deterrent. And at the same time, you know, it's reasonable to expect that it keeps people safe and that the standard of accommodation is reasonable. And those two objectives are at odds with one another. Now, the last Conservative administration had, you know, two big policies that it was embarked on. One was the Rwanda scheme, sending people seeking asylum to be processed offshore. And the other was a large sites program, you know, moving people out of hotels or homes in the community into sites like the Bibby Stockholm Barge or ex-military barracks. The interesting thing about both of those policies is that they're not new. These were things that David Blunkett was trying to enact when he was Home Secretary, you know, more than 20 years ago. And they weren't effective then. They had to be dropped. And so, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the, you know, or there was the Conservative government taking a hard line on these things and bringing in radical policies to tackle the problem. But these aren't radical. These are policies that have been tried before and didn't work then, and they didn't work, you know, in recent years.
That's all for now. Thanks so much to Mark for joining us, and thanks to our listeners at home for tuning in. If you enjoyed this podcast, then head to our website at prospectmagazine.co.uk or to our app, where you can find all of our amazing journalism, including Mark's revealing piece, The Asylum King, and more incisive investigative work from our latest issue of the magazine.
It can be hard balancing taking care of kids, senior loved ones, and yourself. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Find background-checked sitters, nannies, and senior caregivers who can help with everything from watching kids after school to senior meal prep. Whether you need full-time, part-time, or even occasional help, you can view rates and book highly rated caregivers that fit your budget and schedule. Get the help you need with Care.com.
If your small business has a problem, you could say,
"Ugh, just my luck."
But you should say,
"Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there."
And we'll help get you back in business. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.